Welcome, you dice rolling, role playing nerds, to episode 47 of the Nerds Travaganza podcast, where tonight we've got a gaming industry luminary in store for you as our special guest. I'm Tom.
I'm Rick.
I'm Ryan.
And before we introduce tonight's special guest, I think we should kick things off in our traditional fashion by rolling the dice and randomizing the order in which we report our Geekly Weekly Roundup. Hang on, let me roll some dice. I don't have a convincing sound effect. I just rolled some dice, and look at that. Well, what do you know? Brian came up first. What have you been up to, sir?
Pretty boring week. Amazing weekend. Friday night was spent with several of my favorite people and a few that I try to keep my distance from, playing Star Wars miniatures with the new ships. And it was like the first time all over again. The Falcon's awesome. The Falcon's amazing. The Falcon's different. That was fun. And then Saturday, my entire Saturday pretty much was dedicated to International Tabletop Game Day. So I made the circuit. I went from store to store to store, entering contests, demoing brand new games, winning raffles, actually. That was cool. I won a Walking Dead board game.
Nice.
And et cetera, that kind of stuff.
So yeah, et cetera, that kind of stuff. Okay. Cool, man. Sounds like a fun gaming-filled week for you. How about you, Ricky? What have you been up to?
I, too, spent my Friday night at GXE playing X-Wing with the rest of the Nerdstravaganza crew. And I agree with Brian wholeheartedly, 1,000,000,000%. Playing the epic battle we had on Friday night was like breathing brand new breath into the game, man. I don't know if it's because we haven't played in a little while, or if it's because the new ship, or the combination of the two, but man, it was awesome. We had a very storybook type of battle. We had the Millennium Falcon set up with Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, Chewbacca, and outfitted to the nines. And then we had a Imperial crew of Darth Vader and a couple of other well-known backstabbing Mahler Mythal fucking cohorts. And the battle that took place was just insane, man. Without getting into any details, like specific details, it was just... The dark side thought we were going to get our asses handed to us. We ended up winning. But it was such a fantastic fight to see the Falcon take on a squad of four TIEs. I mean, it was just... It was awesome. We're going to have to do some kind of filming of these battle reports or something. Because it was badass. And other than that, I was so head in the clouds, excited about my rebirth of this Star Wars game, that unfortunately I didn't get to make the rounds to all the game stores that I wanted to on Saturday. But I did make it over to Bass Pro Shops and grabbed myself a new case for my Star Wars stuff. So after playing an epic game and after seeing Brian's killer case that April had decorated up for him, needless to say, I needed to get my own. So I spent my Saturday hunting down the perfect box, which ended up being a double box of the same one Brian has. So one side set up for dark, one side set up for light, one side set up for good, one side set up for evil, one side set up to kick ass, and the other side is also set up to kick ass. And other than that, more Peggle till my eyes bleed, and that's it.
Cool, who knew that Bass Pro Shop was a place to go for your gaming needs?
I did.
Besides us?
What about you? What have you been up to?
On the gaming front, this was a week of concessions. This was a week of me adopting the internet philosophy of ain't nobody got time for that, and applying it to games.
Tom didn't have no shoes on or nothing.
Lord, I've got emphysema, or whatever that lady had. Final Fantasy 13, you know, there were all these like really all these monster hunting quests, and I kind of decided I didn't want to waste any more time on them, especially when they started getting hard. So I made a rush for the exit, and I am on the last, what I think is the last battle, which is proving difficult. But rather than losing my cool, I put that game aside, and one Saturday morning when I'm fresh with coffee, I'm gonna conclude that game and then decide after the fact if I want to go back and do all the side quests. Probably not. And as Brian can attest, on the Super Mario Brothers game for the Wii U, I after a
you know
lot
all
of...
that time, I thought we were actually fighting Bowser, and then Junior shows up. I was kind of let down.
Yeah, I really thought I was closer to the end of that game than I was, and I'm just trying to power through it before I play anything else, and just kind of didn't rage quit, but quit before, at Brian's urging, quit before I raged, and I have to thank you for that, Brian. Kind of put that aside, and we'll revisit it later. Brian's helping me play through it in boost mode, which makes things infinitely easier, because your friend can use the tablet to basically do like this God Overwatch thing where he provides platforms for you to jump on and attacks your enemies and stuff. So we'll get back to that. Instead of waiting to finish these other games before I started new ones, I decided, you know what, I just want to do stuff that I like. So I popped in the Epic Mickey 2 for the Wii U and joined Rick in being somewhat disappointed by that game, especially after having liked the first one so much.
Damn! Really?
Just because I can't use the Wiimote, I have to use... I can't believe I'm saying this. Instead of the Wiimote, I have to use the more standard controller configuration provided by the tablet. And that game doesn't translate well to a normal gamepad, I don't think. It works much better with the Wiimote.
Yep.
So I might have to pick up the regular Wii version of that if I really want to play through it. Also, finally broke down and picked up the Monster Hunter game for the Wii U, and I will hopefully be able to report on that for you next week. And aside from video gaming, of course, I was there during the International Board Gaming Day when Brian won his awesome Walking Dead game. We played a round of it, and it immediately got our asses handed to us.
I did look into it a little bit. Apparently, that was just god-awful luck. But I do kind of like that it was pretty much true to the series. Rick, we were playing for like 30 seconds, and one of the like flash mobs of zombies came around and just ate Tom and ended the game. So
yeah, it was like I drew like one zombie horde card after another, and I'm like using all of my like resource cards to fight them off. And I was like, oh, okay, you know what? I'm kind of done. But yeah, International Board Game Day was cool. We made the rounds, check out what all the different stores were doing. And it's very timely, given our guest this week. One of the spots, I would say the highlight of the day, was our visit to the Adventure Game Store. And I think we had a pretty awesome time there. The new space is almost fully fleshed out. The vision is almost fully realized. And I think that leads us very nicely into our interview with tonight's guest. We are joined tonight by our special guest, Brian Dalrymple of Adventure Game Store fame. Adventure Game Store being one of Nerdstravaganza's favorite gaming haunts. How are you, sir?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
And I should specify that you are owner and managing member of the Adventure Game Store empire. I think that's a fair way to describe your position at the enterprise.
Sure. Yep. No, that's me.
Great. And empire, you like the word empire, I assume.
Well, if it's one of those empires that gets kind of like kicked around and moved a little bit here and there, then I guess that's appropriate.
Okay. Well, empire, the borders of empires do tend to shift.
Yes, they do.
So that said, I guess we'll launch right into a discussion of the AGS Empire. So give us a little background on Adventure Game Store. It's been in the South Florida area in one form or another for some time.
Okay. Well, the Adventure Game Store is the name of the new store. We've tried to kind of bring together the old store name and the new store name together. So the full title, the full name, I should say, of the new store is the Adventure Game Store and Dragon's Lair. The Dragon's Lair is the store that was our store that we started up. When I say we, would be Thomas Alcorn. who was the manager at the Complete Strategist when it had a terrible fire in 1988, started the Dragon's Lair. I was working for him at the Strategist as the assistant manager. And he opened the Dragon's Lair in 1988, and I became the manager because he became the owner. But our jobs were pretty much the same for several years until I kind of took over more and more control of the business. The Adventure Game Store is kind of just the current name for the Dragon's Lair. A lot of our customers, our longtime customers, still call us the Lair or the Dragon's Lair. So we've tried to, in opening up the new space, have an official Dragon's Lair spot in the store, our back room, where I'm speaking to you from now. So, yeah, 1988 would make 25 years this year. This is going to be our 25th anniversary in October.
Wow, remarkable, remarkable. You just confirmed something on a personal note for me. I always brag about how I was at the Complete Strategist on at least one occasion in my youth, and 1988 would have made that plausible. So I will now claim for posterity that I did go to that venue and was Complete Strategist and have therefore been with you every step of the way as a snot-nosed kid / customer.
Awesome, awesome. That was the place to go. When I was a kid, fifth and sixth grade, getting into role-playing games, a bunch of us would pile into one of our parents' station wagon, and she would drop us off up the Complete Strategist for an hour or so, and we could kind of just get lost in the game store and seeing all the really neat stuff there. So when I started going to college and had my own transportation and stuff, I found my way up to the Strategist several times a week, and eventually wound up gaming there, and eventually wound up getting hired there. So that's kind of how that all took place.
Very cool. Very cool. And our Brian, do you recall having been to the Complete Strategist, or was Dragon's Lair your first experience?
I have a vague memory of a place before the Dragon's Lair, but I've got no recollection of the name or anything. And my location doesn't agree with your location, so I don't think it was... I can't think of what else it would have been.
Well, the Complete Strategist opened in Davie in, I want to say, 1978.
Was it up there on Sterling near Turnpike?
That's exactly where it was. Sterling near Turnpike. Yep.
That was the place. I was there and didn't know its name.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why, you know, we're still kind of in that same area. Is we were all, you know, strat rats, they called us, and... When we had the fire and it became evident that the owners were not going to reopen the Strategist, Tommy decided he wanted his own store. He'd always wanted his own store, eventually, and he kind of got rushed into it, opening up the Dragon's Lair. We found a location close by, you know, walking distance kind of from the old Strategist location. And when I was scouting out locations for the new shop, the what's now the Adventure Game Store, I tried to keep it in proximity to the Strategist, and also kind of what was the hub for gaming when I was growing up down here in the 80s, which would be the Broward Game Players Club, which was right down the street, right down Davie Road.
Cool. So a lot of history there. And this is a historical moment. We are now going to change the name of our podcast to Strat Rats Talk. That's a cool name.
That is a cool name.
Cool. So we've established there's been a great deal of history in our area, and that's continuing to this day. Would you say that you have, do you see a lot of young college age folks coming in who are sort of the new generation of strat rats?
Absolutely. Every 5 to 10 years or so, we get I guess we should say we have a kind of a constant group of new people coming in and playing, and we've got customers that have been with us for 25 years, or people that, you know, went to the Strategist when I was going there as a kid that still pop in. Some of them still come into play, and we have a group of kids that are, when I say kids, they're 20 years old, which is how old I was when I started working in this business, we've got a group of them that's going to be coming down here on Sundays to play with us, and we've had several 15 to 20 year olds that play with us 3 or 4 times a week.
Wow, it's great to see history repeating itself. I was in my younger teenage years. I think maybe we all were when we we had our first experiences with tabletop and role-playing gaming. So
that's typical. They say about 13 years old, I guess, really, for just about any hobby that you kind of stays with you for a while. That's about the age you get into it.
Yeah, I guess your brain starts to function on all four cylinders at that point, and you start to identify things that you like a little more clearly. So you mentioned that your love of gaming got you into the industry. What, if you can recall, what was your first exposure to gaming? What got you into it initially as a player?
Oh, well, it kind of happened in spots. When I was in elementary school, this is like fifth or sixth grade, that's about the time that the advanced D&D books started to come out, and some friends of mine showed up with them one afternoon at lunch in the cafeteria, and we were looking through the books, and you know, it was cool, and it was really kind of neat, and none of us really had any idea what to do with them or how to run it, but all of us knew that that's what we wanted for Christmas or for Hanukkah, and so we all kind of got our sets in about the same year, which would be probably like 1980-81, which is also about the same time that D&D starts to really hit the mainstream. You know, E.T. Featured a first edition D&D game in its opening scenes, and that's the time when it was really kind of first really pushing out there and hit the mainstream. And that's when I got into it, along with, I'm sure, millions of other people. And I played with my friends through junior high school. And then it turned out that there was a neighbor a few blocks up from me who was probably 5 or 6 years older than me. He was in college and ran for his fraternity at the University of Miami. And I guess, you know, between semesters or when his friends were kind of moving on and moving out of state, he would try to look for other people to play with, and he was a member of the Broward Game Players Club. So he would run for me and a couple of my friends a few times over the course of the summer. We would do little campaigns over the summer, and he brought me with him to the Broward Game Players Club several times, where he would play and I would kind of hang out and watch. It was really a pretty cool place. They were impossibly huge at that time in my head. You know, 2,500 square feet, private gaming room, tons of tables. They had a bar. They served snacks. They had computers for gaming in like 1982.
Wow.
It was just a really, really neat place. And you actually had to be 18 to be a full member there. But if you weren't, you were allowed there on the weekends if a member brought you. And that was how I did it. And then, I guess after I became 18 and started going to school, I was like, you know, I wonder if that Game Players Club is still up there. And I went there, and it was. And I mean, we're talking a club that was principally for role players and war gamers. This is all, you know, pre-card games, unless you're talking like nuclear war or something like that. That had 400, 500 active members. Just in kind of the Broward area, mostly. Open 6 days a week and just, you know, filled with people every night playing games. And when I went back there, when I was in college, I wound up getting in with a few groups and I played there a lot. And the Complete Strategist was kind of just around the corner up on Sterling Road. And of course, I remember going there to shop when I was a kid, so... it just became a natural thing. If I was going up to the Game Players Club to play, I would stop at the Strategist beforehand, hang out, do a little shopping, because the club didn't open until 6. My classes got out around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so I had a little time to kill. I got to play games and met the guys that were working there, one of whom became my boss, Tommy, who opened the Dragon's Lair.
Wow. Wow. And this club, was it a run by member dues or anything, or was it just sort of a...
There were dues. They were not expensive. I want to say, in the early 80s, I want to say it was $30 or $35 a year. It was kept open through the sale of snacks and food. They sold no game product there at all. Their attitude was that they wanted to be a club and not a store, and they wanted the support of the local retail stores. So by not selling product, they were not in competition with anyone, and they could advertise the club in those stores to try to draw members in.
Interesting. Especially when I consider the latest incarnation of the Adventure Game Store and Dragon's Lair, which seems to have elements of both a very well laid out retail store and the polish of a club environment. Would you say that you drew inspiration from your early days at this club?
Absolutely. I drew inspiration from probably a lot of different places, but the Game Players Club is certainly one of them. Others might be, if you might remember the Adventurer Society at Pleasure Island, any nice Barnes & Noble. There's a rather impossible game shop in Seattle called Card Kingdom, which is the retail outlet for a major internet magic singles and magic pack dealer in the Pacific Northwest. They sunk an enormous amount of money into building just a gorgeous, gorgeous game store. It's got its own restaurant attached to it, its own full bar attached to it. And they went all out, just making this place completely gorgeous. There's the house that I lived in when I was doing a lot of my gaming, where I didn't really grow up there, but I lived in a house in North Miami that was very kind of warm and woody. Lots of dark wood fixtures and walls and stuff like that. I thought, you know, all of those things kind of together kind of gelled in my mind about what I wanted to do with the space. And I didn't have the kind of budget for build out that folks up in the Card Kingdom in Seattle had. But I thought, you know, how I could kind of come as close as I could on a much, much smaller budget. And with a little help from IKEA and Craigslist, I was able to make it happen.
Well, you were definitely successful in laying out a very inviting environment. I know I've mentioned this before in private conversations, but I can't think of another gaming store in our area that is as inviting as yours is now.
Well, thanks. You know, I mean, I guess partly because it was inspired a bit by coffee shops or by like someone's house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, I want it to have that kind of feel, like you're coming into somebody's house or that's comfortable and nice. And I have worked in and have been in plenty of game stores that were just big or had just tons and tons of tables or were loud, cramped. I wanted to, with this store, I was kind of rebelling against all of the other stores that I've worked in, and trying to put together something that would be just a comfortable, nice place for middle-aged folks like myself to come and relax, and hopefully younger and older folks would enjoy as well.
Well, mission accomplished. I think it definitely flies in the face of the stereotypical dingy basement or grimy warehouse that I've seen in my gaming travels.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, there's quite a lot of stores out there that kind of fit that bill. Although they are changing over. I think there's a definite movement in the direction of nicer stores. And at the Gamma Trade Show this past week, that was something that Wizards of the Coast was emphasizing very strongly. That their keynote address at the dinner was called "It's All About Quality." And they ran pictures, for better or for worse, of some stores that maybe are kind of fit that kind of old school example. I don't know how many of them are still open, and some of them might be doing great. You know, I've worked at the Dragon's Lair. It was a pit for a long time, but it was our pit. We loved it, and it was great to kind of wallow around in it. But the new space in the direction I see, I think eventually a lot of stores are going to wind up going, are going to follow kind of what I'm doing here. I'm not necessarily trying to pack in bodies, but I want to have something that's a quality experience for the people that we can handle, because it's like a neighborhood bar almost. I mean, mm-hmm. You want your bar to be a comfortable place because you know that someplace you're going to sit down and you're going to be there for hours. So you should be comfortable while you're doing it. It should be nice.
That's a really good analogy, because that's exactly how it feels when we go hang out. I mean, we'll go and hang out at your store rather than go ahead and hang out at a bar. So to have it set up all nice and that cool homey vibe, it definitely was a huge turn on to walk in and see what you guys did with the new space. And another thing that really surprised me, you're talking about not packing the bodies in, the chameleon-esque transformation of the store between the first day I came in and saw it and then when I came in on International or Board Game Day, how you guys had moved some of the mobile shelving units and stuff like that to create nooks and crannies and like a little bit more of a private game area and opened up another bigger spot out in the back. It blew my mind. I was like, I can't believe this is the same place because
really
it seems so much bigger. And it was a brilliant design on all fronts on your part for that. It was phenomenal.
Well, thanks. You know, I wish I could take credit, but you know, it's one of those little things that, you know, when I go to town, which, you know, still a few times a year, you know, I'll visit other stores. When I go to the trade show or Gen Con or Origins, I'll talk to other store owners, and that's a stolen idea, the shelves on wheels. But the fact that we were able to get our shelving from IKEA just made it a natural thing to do, because we knew that we'd want to be able to adapt the space that we had, because even though the space we're in right now is probably three times the size of our previous space, it's not as big as we'd like it to be all the time, but mm-hmm. having the flexibility to move stuff around means that when we need to, we can accommodate larger events than we could normally.
And another thing to touch on the design aspect that you guys brought in, it does have that clean IKEA looking design throughout the place, and I think that that's going to go over well with some of the people that are just now getting into gaming. When you see stuff like Star Wars, the X-Wings miniatures game at Target, Ticket to Ride at Target, you know, some of these games that we're normally used to seeing in a game store only environment are starting to peek their heads onto the bigger, you know, brick and mortar shelves of these chain stores. And although they don't have a great variety, it's definitely something that could set somebody's hook. And then they start looking, where can I get more games like this, or where can I find people to play these games with? Walk into the typical game place, and they're probably going to be turned off because they haven't been brought up with that culture. It's new to them. But to come in a place like the new AGS, they're ready to grab their Starbucks and plop their asses down, and they're going to stay a spell, guaranteed.
Oh, I remember getting into the role-playing games early on when we were trying to find places where you could buy things like D&D. In the early 80s, I bought D&D books at Sears. There was gaming product on mass market and big box shelves, department store shelves back then, because it was, you know, a cool, hip, new thing that people thought was going to be everywhere. But like you said, I mean, they didn't have everything. They had a selection of modules and some books. I could buy my books at the local bookshop. For me, it was the corner bookstore. But of course, you know, Dalton's and Walden Books had been carrying a small selection of game books for years and years. A lot of people got their first game books that way. But they couldn't get the depth and selection that you can find at an actual, real, friendly local game store. So when I see board games, which are, you know, kind of experiencing that big kind of push into the mainstream over the last 10 years, when I see that stuff showing up at Target, I don't feel threatened by it at all, because I know that if we can actually get people playing that sort of thing, Target's not going to carry the depth of selection I'm going to have. They're not going to have my product knowledge, and they're not going to have a spot for people to sit down and play.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a win-win.
Speaking, it is win-win, Rick. I couldn't agree more. Speaking of places to sit down and play, there's a particularly intriguing aspect of the new space, and that is the private gaming area in the back. It's a large private room with a large, handsome table, which gaming groups can avail themselves of for a peaceful gaming session, let's say, if I understand it correctly. How has that been received so far by your customer base?
So far, I would say enthusiastically, if not like overwhelmingly enthusiastically. I mean, people definitely like having this space. I think for a lot of people that come to play here, just the fact that we have a separate area to keep, if we have two role-playing games going on at the same time, people aren't, you know, talking over each other or joining people out. For them, that's a nice thing to have. The fact that we haven't happened to have a really nice conference table back here, we've got a kitchenette, and all these other amenities that we're going to be adding in as we go forward here, it's a bonus. People really seem to like it. I don't foresee us in the near future having this back room space be more popular to use than the front room space, in part because we aren't charging a modest fee for it. But really, I kind of like that. I kind of like that the people that want to step up and rent the back room space get that exclusivity. They get the food station, the microwave, coffee maker, fridge. They get the discrete Wi-Fi network back here. And within the next few months, we're going to have an IP camera and smart TV, so that they'll be able to do a teleconference and hopefully maybe even connect up with some former gaming buddies that might have moved away. So I would say so far, everyone really, really likes it. It's not booked up or full every night, but we are starting to see more and more requests for it. And I do think that certainly by the summer, I expect it to be pretty solidly booked.
I don't doubt it. It holds a lot of appeal for us. I know that we've spoken about it at length, and the fee you're charging is very reasonable for the privilege of having such a relaxed and private space.
Well, our first priority was to make sure that the space was nice enough that people would be able to look at the fee and say, oh, you know what, this space is really worth the small amount of money that we're talking about. We based our pricing on it on the new Dunkin' Donuts conference rooms that they're building into the new their new restaurants, and they're charging I think $12 an hour for people to use their conference rooms. And our goal is that our conference room will be as nice as one of theirs, as usable as one of theirs. But we're only charging $20 for a game session, and we leave the length of that session up to the people that are renting the space. As long as you don't run into somebody else's booked time, you can use the space as long as you want on a particular day for $20, regardless of the size of your group. We picked $20 because we thought for a typical group it would be about $3 a person.
And how well received would you say the store in its new incarnation is as a whole, both by your existing customers and new people coming in? As I said, it's immediately inviting when you come walking in. So have you gotten any feedback from your customers?
On the whole, it's been just fantastic. I mean, we've gotten so many compliments. Everybody that walks in the door, I mean, you see their eyes kind of open wide, and they're like, oh my God, really? I've had customers coming in and shopping. You know, this is 25 years I've been working here. So, I'll talk with customers all the time, but I've had customers come in and shop, and they will compliment the store four or five or six times while we're in the, just as they're like going through the store. And then on the way out too. So no, it's just been really, really awesome. The level of support and enthusiasm about the space as a whole has just been overwhelming. I couldn't be happier.
Great. Great. I know for my part, at least, I felt like I was almost coming across as not genuine because I couldn't help but compliment the place repeatedly.
And of course, you know, in my mind, there's all these other things that have yet to actually happen to make it look even better. So I'm like, oh, well, it's not even done yet. And we haven't finished, tricking out our lighting and putting the backroom TV in and all this other stuff that we have left to do. So I think by the summer, it's going to look even more amazing.
Wow. And when the inevitable increase in demand warrants the expansion into yet a larger space, would you see doing that with the same level of polish? You know, when you take over the adjacent five or six bays in the complex you're in.
Well, if this works out the way I think it will, I mean, the idea that I had with this spot, coming out of the old spot, we were in a much larger space as the Dragon's Lair. And when we moved into our current shopping center, we were in an even bigger spot. And that is the year that the recession hit. And the recession drove us into a really small space, a little 500 square foot space that, you know, actually served us very well. It let us keep the doors open for 4 years through the recession, despite the fact that we were paying top dollar rent wise, the space was small enough to where it kept our overhead down to the point where we could survive to this point. And in that period of time, rents came down to the point where for what I was paying for the smaller space, I'm paying about the same for what I'm doing now. So having gone through the recession as it was, and knowing that it could have very easily killed us had we not had a very nice landlord that let us accommodate ourselves, with this spot, I didn't want to go too big right away. I wanted it to be something that if nothing changed, if I was wrong and we didn't get any increase in business at all, at the revenue levels that we were at in the smaller space, we would still be able to sustain ourselves in the new space. And keeping that in mind, I wanted to gear the new space toward basically saying thank you to the people that have been customers with us through the smaller space, give them a nice place to play in, give them something comfortable, and let them feel that, you know, it's pretty much their space for having stuck with us as they were. We didn't want to necessarily go big. We wanted to be able to serve the customers that have been our friends and customers for a long time in a nice way. And if it turns out that we wind up getting a whole bunch of customers as a result of that, and we can start looking at expanding, I would definitely continue in the vein that we are now. I would add some more private space, and I would do more with the flexible open space, so that if I wanted to hold a large event, a mini convention or something like that, I would have the flexibility with the shelves to kind of push them aside so that I could have the open space on the days that I needed it.
Nice. So my final question on the new space. So you've got a very loyal base of customers who have come with you. Have you found that they've adopted sort of a sense of ownership over the place, meaning, you know, with its new level of quality, are they extra careful about keeping the place up and not leaving the errant, you know, snack wrapper laying around and that sort of thing?
By and large, yes. By and large, our regulars really appreciate the space. You know, they treat it, I guess one of the benefits, I guess, of having a store that feels like somebody's house is you feel like you're in somebody's house. And if you're a longtime customer, it's kind of your house. So you want to keep it looking nicer. I mean, we still have to pick up after a few people, but nothing on the level that we have had to in previous stores where, you know, a group would leave and the table would just be covered with all kinds of trash. I'd have to, you know, take out this way. Typically, a lot of times, you know, they'll clean the table up, they'll wipe it down before they go, which is amazing.
Let's hope it lasts. That'd be fantastic.
I think it will. I think it brings out the best in people when they're in an environment they respect and want to keep nice. So.
Oh, I think so. If you provide something nice to people and they like it, you know, they want to have the niceness stay around and they're willing to put forth the effort to keep it nice.
So, Brian, in addition to your involvement with AGS or AGSDL, as we're calling it, if we add Dragon's Lair to the end of it, you are also involved, and the store is also involved, in the Game Manufacturers Association, or GAMA. The store is a retail member, you mentioned to us, and you are actually you've been a long-serving member on the board. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. GAMA is the trade organization for the adventure games industry. GAMA puts on two big shows every year. The first of which that I just went to is the GAMA Trade Show, which for the last 10 years has been taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's probably going on 12 or 13 years now. Although there's probably been maybe 30 GAMAs. They began in Las Vegas, and for a while in the 90s, the early 90s, they started moving the show around, and that's how I got involved. They moved for a couple of years to New Orleans. I had a friend who used to be a customer here at the shop who had moved to New Orleans, and I was able to stay with him. And I had just sold a bunch of my Magic singles, and I'd always wanted to make that trip, and Las Vegas always seemed so pricey and impossible to do, but New Orleans seemed a lot easier to try. And I went to my first GAMA trade show in, I want to say, 1994, I've been to every one since. So this year was my 19th Gamma Trade Show.
And did I hear you right when you say that your inaugural trip was funded by the sale of cards?
Yep.
That's perfect.
My trips to Gamma, my first two Gamma Trade Shows and my first two Gen Cons were financed with the sale of my beta set, which in retrospect I should have kept in the boxes. But I guess we all feel that way, and that's probably why they're worth so much.
I suppose so. Wow, that is just so that's just so perfectly gamer, that story. I love that.
My very first distributor sales rep in the business, the people with whom we speak every week and place our orders, was a volunteer on the Gamma board in the position that I'm currently holding, which is the corporate secretary. He encouraged me to take the trip out there, and it's just an amazing experience. The Gamma Trade Show is it's a B2B show. It's all industry professionals, retailers, wholesalers, manufacturers. And the point of the show is to kind of unveil the year's new product in advance so that all the stores kind of know what's coming out. And at the same time, to educate stores on the best practices for staying in business. And again, this is where you pick up a lot of neat ideas, like putting shelves on wheels, and you know, the benefits of having a private gaming space, or making your store look nice. There's a lot of education that takes place at the Gamma Trade Show from so many game store owners did not have any kind of real business background. Most of us were just game players that wanted to go into business doing the thing that they love, and that's a kind of a recipe for disaster if you don't know what you're doing. And one of the things that Gamma does a really good job of is helping stores learn how to be a good retail store and stay in business for a good length of time. And certainly the lessons that I learned going to the Gamma Trade Show helped me weather the recession and a lot more.
So very informative from a business perspective, in addition to being probably pretty cool to attend.
It really is a pretty cool show to go to. But I mean, so a lot of my customers are like, oh, I wish I could go to it. And I'm like, you know, you would be bored out of your socks half the time because so much of it is business.
Mm.
But you do get to see all of the really neat games that are coming out. And they do have a game night, which is, I guess, a relatively recent thing. We've been doing it, I guess, for 6 or 7 years now, where the manufacturers will, one evening for, I guess, 6 hours, let you demo all of the new stuff that they've got coming out for the coming year. And some of it is pre-production. Some of it is still on, you know, business cards or typing paper. I got to demo Sedition Wars last year with Mike McVeigh, the sculptor and designer of the game, and was blown away by it. And when it actually got released over Christmas, I made sure that I had it to stock. So that's how that kind of stuff works, and it's great to see ideas becoming actual product. And of course, we get to see a lot more of that nowadays with crowdfunding and Kickstarter, but it all kind of feeds into the same sort of thing.
So I'd like to actually get to crowdfunding and Kickstarter in a moment, but before we do, I'd like to just ask about this particular show that you recently came back from one of the Gamma trade shows.
Yes.
And how was this show compared with previous years?
Well, this was an excellent show. Very, very well attended. It was a lot of really, really great stuff out there in the hall. I mean, nothing. There wasn't any like one magnificent, oh my God, this is going to be an amazing product for everyone type product. But everybody had a great catalog of new stuff that they were coming out with. The energy level was very high. There were a lot of retailers at the show. It was certainly a 10-year record for a number of retailers. It could have been maybe an overall record, because during the peak years at the Gamma Trade Show, one of the things that used to happen at the Gamma Trade Show a lot was you would be given samples. So when you went out to the show, and the manufacturer was like, oh yeah, we have this new game that we're trying out, and you know, here's a copy of the game we came out last year. and or here's a preview of the new game that's coming out pretty soon. And what wound up happening was there were a lot of people that started going to the show that actually weren't professionals in the business, that didn't actually own stores. We think we couldn't verify that a lot of these places were actual stores, and attendance wound up really, really getting big when a lot of these show exclusives started being given away, and then after the show, people would, you know, put them up on eBay or add them to their collections. I mean, that's the manufacturers for the most part didn't mind that there were a lot of people going to the show. They liked that there were a lot of people there, but there's only so much face time that you can get when you're a manufacturer and you want to talk with the retailers that are selling your product. I mean, you want to actually be talking to legitimate retailers, people that are going to be carrying and ordering your game over the course of this year and years to come, rather than somebody who's just there to get the cool new free thing. So we changed the way that we give out samples at the show, and we actually send the samples out to your store 30 to 60 days after the show is over. So we have ways to verify that you're an actual store, and we have ways to make sure that you're getting stuff that you can use. And that has really helped make it so that what transpires on the floor of the Gamma Trade Show is game business related talk. And in that way, it was excellent. It was a great, great show. People that have only been coming for a while have said it was their best. For me, I'd say it was a top five show for sure. It was a great show, very well done. I should mention, I said that the Gamma is one of two shows that the Gamma Trade Show is one of two shows that Gamma puts on. The second is the second largest consumer game show in the U.S., and that is Origins, and it takes place in Columbus, Ohio, in June. That's about a 14,000 person consumer game show. I've heard it described as if Gen Con is the United States of gaming conventions, Origins is the Canada of gaming conventions. It's nicer, it's smaller, and you have a real good time with it.
And it's very polite.
Yes, yes. Would you say that, maybe as evidenced at this latest show, that the gaming industry in general is ascendant? It seems to me as a consumer that there's an exploding number of options.
In part, you can thank crowdfunding for that. If there was a buzzword on the floor of the Gamma Trade Show this year, it was Kickstarter.
Mm.
Every company of small to moderate size that has a really cool new project that they're working on is putting it up on a crowdfunding site so that it can see the light of day. And because of that, we're going to start to see lots and lots of really, really cool things coming out. Board games, as you know, have been kind of on the rise for about a good decade here. And that's continuing to take place. Board games are still really kind of driving gameplay, especially among the mainstream, which is why you're seeing them in Target and Barnes & Noble and lots of other places like that. I would say that crowdfunding is going to enable quality products to enter the marketplace that are kind of market tested in a way, because they wouldn't get funded if it wasn't something that someone had an interest in the first place. And because they're kind of prepaid for, it means that they're going to be better looking. The people who are designing and putting them out are not going to have to mortgage their house or hawk everything that they own. They're not going to be hopefully not going to be in a tremendous amount of debt just from putting out a game. And in the case of role-playing games, which have really kind of been on a downturn for a while, largely because so many really cool role-playing game ideas did not see print. They were published electronically or made available as PDFs or very short print-on-demand print runs. With crowdfunding, you're actually going to be able to get enough money up front to fund an offset print run, which is significantly cheaper per unit to do, offers a higher quality final product. It'll have art. It'll have nice layout. And it'll be available in my shop which I am very thankful for, at a reasonable price, which we just haven't had that in a while. And that's one of the reasons why I think role-playing games kind of struggled for about the last 10 years. And there's plenty of shops that have only been open for 10 or 12 years that for whom collectible card games and miniatures and now for the last 10 years board games have been what they carried. And I think crowdfunding coming along the way it is going to be a huge shot in the arm, not just for board games and miniatures and stuff like that, but also hugely for role-playing games. The successful funding percentage for role-playing games on crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter is way, way, way above the overall average. Like double.
Wow. So interesting. I think of crowdfunded projects as sort of direct from creator to consumer, but that it from based on what you're saying, a better way to think about it would be you get buy-in from consumers, and then after that you're able to go to retailers with a proven product that they can carry, so they end up benefiting.
Absolutely. Retail and wholesale both benefit tremendously that way. I use Zombicide as an example. I talked with Dave Doust from Cool Mini or Not at the show, and although he wouldn't divulge all of his numbers to me, the impression I got from him certainly was that the amount of Zombicide that went out direct to Kickstarter backers is like a single-digit percentage of their overall sales, which would mean, you know, 9 out of 10 Zombicides were sold through wholesale and retail. Wow.
I'm shocked at the multiplier effect of that. But I guess if you get, I mean, it must be, now that I think about it, it must be appealing for you as a retailer to have a buzz for this product the minute it hits your store shelves, as opposed to having to worry about somebody coming in off the street, sight unseen, and just picking the box off.
Oh, absolutely. It helps my product knowledge. It also helps me, because we back a number of projects. One of the big projects I'm looking forward to later this year is the new edition of Tunnels and Trolls, which we were a retail backer of. We just kicked in for the Dwarven Forge dungeon terrain Kickstarter that's running right now. And we've backed 20-some-odd different crowdfunding projects, and probably would have backed more if we could afford it, because we want to have some participation and some say in really cool stuff that we think deserves to come out.
So actual retailers are engaged in the process. It's not you're not only benefiting from the ready-made buzz, but you're throwing your weight behind promising projects.
Absolutely. Not every retailer, of course, but many, many retailers are.
Progressive, forward-thinking retailers like AGS is what I meant to say.
Okay, sure.
Industry leaders.
Some of us, yes. Some of us, hopefully.
Cool. Now, you mentioned something in a discussion we had prior to the show where you were involved in crafting a set of best practice guidelines for somebody doing a Kickstarter or other crowdsourcing project so that they would play optimally with retailers. Would you care to elaborate on that at all?
As much as I can. I mean, it's very much in its infancy. It was an idea that actually I brought to the president of Gamma at this past trade show. So a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about this, I said, listen, you know, women, as the trade association, we're kind of in a unique position to be able to go to these crowdfunding sites and say, listen, you know, I mean, we kind of know what we're talking about here. Here's what we think are good ideas when you're trying to put together a project, because just like someone that decides to open up a game store, not necessarily knowing what they need to do and having a good solid head on their shoulders from a business standpoint, a game designer that wants to come out with a product that they're going to produce in large quantity and put through the distribution chain might also be in that similar situation. They know more about games and game design than actually project management, wholesale sales, print quote negotiation, all of the other things that come into that way, and what you need to do in order for your product to be available on retail store shelves. And the overwhelming majority of people that are doing crowdfunded gaming projects do want their products available for sale in retail game stores. And this is a way that we can help that come to pass. So the Gamma president, Rick Loomis of Flying Buffalo, put together a committee, of which I'm a member of the committee now, and we're going to, at Gen Con, kind of finalize our recommendations, and in the fall, we'll hopefully have a nice shiny document that we can give to people like Indiegogo and Kickstarter to add to their library of materials that they would give out to prospective crowdfunding project makers.
So there you have it, a codified backing of crowdsourced projects from brick and mortar retailers, I guess we could say.
Both retailers and wholesalers.
You know? I keep leaving wholesalers out because as a consumer, I don't see that end of things, but yes.
Sure, yeah, that's, you know, in my background, when I started working for Tommy at the Dragon's Lair and kind of running the shop, I worked for him for, I guess, about 10 years, 10, 11 years, I suppose. And the one break that I took from working in retail, I had offered to purchase the store from Tommy in, I guess, 1999, and he declined, and I completely understand that. He loved the store, and I had an offer to go to work for a wholesaler. And when Tom decided he wasn't going to sell the store to me, I took that opportunity and I worked for 3 years for a wholesaler. So I kind of have that perspective as well. And I was with them for 3 years, and out of the blue, I get a call from Tommy 3 years later asking me if I still wanted to buy the store. And I said, you bet I do. So that's how I wound up coming to own the store. And this is my 11th year owning the store.
And your resume, you've been through the whole vertical stack from player to wholesale back to retail. There's every facet of gaming you've participated in.
Well, in recent years, I've actually also gotten involved in the publishing side of things too, in an effort to try to get some kind of understanding about how all that stuff works. Oh. So I have a small publishing company called Gamer Ingenuity. We published a character folio for the Pathfinder role-playing game 2 years ago, and it has been selling consistently through distribution for the last 2 years. We've sold about 4,000 units, and in the fall of this past year, I was invited to a game designers conference in New Jersey called Metatopia, where a bunch of very small game publishing companies, mostly role-playing and board game companies, get together to talk design and the kind of unique struggles that a small publisher has to go through in getting a project to market. And Kickstarter figured into that discussion as well, too, so that I have that kind of information to draw on as well.
Interesting. So I just the names of these different organizations and companies make me think, wow, this guy has a cool job.
I know, right?
Is it fair to say that you're sort of kind of living your dream to a certain extent? I mean, you love gaming and you can't be any more into gaming than you are.
I'd say that's fair. You know, they say that if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. And I think that's definitely true for me.
The big question, yeah, though, do you still get to play as much?
I do. Although I'm frustrated because the game that I wrapped up in December, I've been working on trying to lay the ground for the new game that I'm going to be running. It's just we've had one frustration after another. Well, frustrations. I opened the store, if that's a frustration. So I've had other things that have kept me busy and kept me from actually running. But the whole time that I've been working in the games industry, there's maybe a grand – in 25 years, there's maybe 4 or 5 months of that time where I was not running or playing in something.
That's awesome.
The joke that used to go around the Dragon's Lair was that Tommy, the original owner, opened up the Dragon's Lair so that he would always have a place to play and no one could ever kick him out of any game he was in.
A definite fringe benefit. I would, probably not fringe, a definite core benefit, I would say. Perfect segue, Rick, because that brings me to, I think, the final compound question I have for you, Brian. What are you playing? what's hot coming down the pike that you want to play, etc. What are, when you do have time to play, what are you playing and what are you looking forward to playing?
All right, well, mostly, having gotten started in role-playing, I consider myself first and foremost a role-playing gamer, although I play all games from every category. I saw a lot of really cool things at the Gamma Trade Show, and a lot of the stuff you guys have probably been following on Kickstarter as well. My favorite role-playing system has always been the Palladium system, and there is a supplement coming out for their Robotech role-playing game, which is a miniatures battle game that will incorporate figures from all of the Macross and Robotech stuff, coincidentally in a scale that would be playable with Battletech, which was my first big miniatures game that I got into. And really is kind of the game that got the Dragon's Lair on its feet. Everybody played Battletech back in the day. And due to some issues over intellectual property rights and images, a number of the very early Battletech figures have not been produced in a large number of years. And the Robotech RPG Tactics game that's coming out in December, brought to you by Kickstarter, is going to have nearly all of those figure designs available again. Whether you're going to be playing Robotech or Battletech, that's kind of cool to see.
Those are going to make my originals less special, aren't they?
I don't know. What scale are your originals in? They're probably going to be bigger, I would think, than these.
I'm not sure, actually.
These are going to be Battletech scale, so they're going to be, I guess, technically 1/300 scale. So they're going to be probably smaller than the ones that that you've had from bygone years. So I'm looking forward to that. If you're a Shadowrun player, this is a huge year for Shadowrun. It's their anniversary year. They're coming out with a fifth edition, and they're coming out with a Shadowrun game for every single market segment. So there's the role-playing game. They're doing a deck-building game called Crossfire. They're doing a miniatures game called Sprawlgangers.
Uh-oh.
They're doing an MMO. They've just got a ton of Shadowrun stuff is coming down the pipe this year for people like Shadowrun. I thought that was pretty cool. X-Wing from Fantasy Flight, which you guys, of course, are familiar with. WizKids has licensed the combat system from the X-Wing game from Fantasy Flight, and they're producing a Star Trek ship combat game that uses the same system from X-Wing, and I think that's going to be really big.
Yes.
Of course,
do you know if they're going to be compatible? Like, will you be able to play Star Wars against Star Trek?
You will not. They're not compatible.
What, are you going to have, like, a runabout take on an X-Wing, Rick?
Yeah, there are a lot more ship systems on the big starship than on the little small one-man fighters that X-Wing has you cover. And the Millennium Falcon figure from X-Wing, would, like, you could drop, like, 10 galaxy-class ships in that same kind of space. So, yeah, it's a completely different scale. The system works in very much the same way, but there's a lot more layers in terms of who your captain is and, you know, all the other systems on board the ship. Give it a little more sophistication. Role-playing wise, from Fantasy Flight this year, the Star Trek RPG, the beta for that is already out, along with the beginner box. But the very first of three books that they're coming out with for that game comes out at the beginning of this summer, which is their it's like their Bounty Hunters and Scoundrels game, and then they're going to follow that up with a like a Rebel Alliance book, and then finally a Force book, so you'll be able to play Jedi one book after the other, but they'll all be compatible and playable as separate games. So that's pretty cool. We just got in Relic, which is the 40K version of Talisman from Fantasy Flight. And that's neat. They're going to be doing a lot of stuff for Descent this year. If you guys are fans of Descent, or I get the game that it was originally kind of sort of based on, the HeroQuest.
Nice.
So that was pretty cool. Board game wise, tons and tons of fantastic board games coming out. More support for Zombicide. If you guys like Red Dragon Inn from Slugfest Games, there's a Red Dragon Inn 4 that's coming out this year, along with some solo packs for those guys. And one of the things I thought was pretty cool is Osprey Publishing. I'm a role player, but I'm also kind of secondly a miniatures gamer. And the two shows that the store actually goes to exhibit and participate in the state of Florida are both historical miniatures shows. And Osprey is the publishing house that produces reference books for history, for aimed at gamers. So if you wanted to find out about anything that took place in history, a particular war or battle or a type of soldier or a particular, I guess some good examples. Most recently, they came out with they have a series of books called Raids. And they did The Revenge of the 47 Ronin, a whole book just on that. And there's a movie coming out about that particular event later this year. So they try to keep it timely. But all of their books have been kind of straight history books. So in my shop, the books that I've been carrying from them have been mostly things that I can apply toward role-playing games. So Dark Ages stuff, Vikings and knights and Saxons and castles and that kind of stuff. Or when we're doing a World War II or World War I game, biplanes and battleships, things that apply to gaming. But they really do like everything. They do pirates and Napoleonics and the Civil War and modern stuff, just tons and tons of stuff. Well, recently, in the last few years, they started actually publishing their own sets of rules. And they've all been historical rules. They started with a set of modern miniatures rules called Force on Force this past year in partnership with Warlord Games, which is a big producer of World War II miniatures based out of Britain. They produced a rule set called Bolt Action. They did a science fiction rule set called Tomorrow's War. And what they're adding in this year are two series of books geared toward gaming shops like mine that cover things sort of related to history. So they have like a Myths and Legends series that's coming out this year. We have the first two books on the shelf, which are Jason and the Argonauts and The Dragon Slayers, which covers people like St. George and Beowulf and any great heroes of legend that have done battle with dragons. And they're doing more books in that series. They're going to do a book on Thor, a book on Hercules, and that I think is pretty cool. And then Ken Height, who is a role-playing game designer of some renown, who I had the chance to hang out with at Metatopia in the fall, he's mostly known for his works in the Cthulhu mythos as it applies to gaming, but he's a huge, huge history buff. And he is writing a series of books for Osprey, and the first of which is coming out. It's part of a line of books that they're doing, which are books that are about pseudo-history, things that really didn't actually take place, but written as though they did. The first of those books was the Zombie Hunter's Guide, which kind of profiles all the different types of zombies that there are and ways that you fight them. And the first book that Ken is doing is a book on the Nazi occult. Occult Nazis have shown up in fiction and movies, you know, for decades. He has, being the kind of like meticulous historian that he is, has delved into every little legend or rumor about the ways that the Nazis were dabbling into the occult, and has written them into this book, or hopefully series of books, about weapons that the Nazis would have had that were based on runes or mystical energies or that sort of thing. And it's written as though it was an actual historical resource, a historical reference. They're following that with a book on the Templars as a Baphomet demon-worshipping cult of knights. So you have all of these rumors and things that supposedly had happened in history that but really probably didn't actually happen, but written as though they did. And that's kind of a really good resource for game masters that want to incorporate those kinds of things into their campaigns of various types as enemies and storylines and stuff like that. Just really cool stuff from Osprey.
Just when you thought Nazis and Knights Templar couldn't get any more fanatical and crazy, we present an interesting new spin on both concepts. Cool. So it sounds like a pretty exciting batch of games coming our way, and you are availing yourself of the numerous games coming across your bow. So, gotta say, that only increases my level of jealousy. I'm down with the not wanting to work a day in my life thing, but the dream part I don't quite have together.
Well, I guess, you know, it is. There's a lot of effort that's involved, and you know, the financial rewards as of yet are still like hoping to come. But it's just been a real pleasure being able to do this, and I credit my involvement in Gamma for kind of keeping that fire going when things get tough and giving me solutions to problems and ways to kind of work my way out of difficulties that I've managed to put myself into over the years. And hopefully now, finally, with this new location, we're going to have something that is very comfortable, sustainable, that will be, I'm hoping, a place for people to come for years to come.
So in addition to the store being a pretty awesome place to game in its new incarnation, I understand you host some events there. Do you have any gaming events coming up in the near future?
Well, of course, when we just did International Tabletop Day this past weekend, which was phenomenal, just a ton of fun to do. My understanding is, if they can swing it, they're going to try to do it again, perhaps even before a year is up, which would be great.
Nice.
But we're trying to focus on having at least one kind of cool event every month that we can do. And the next one we have scheduled is April 27th. We're going to be doing a miniatures painting class that is going to be geared primarily toward people who are beginners, novice miniatures painters. We're going to have some expert painters that have won painting contests, myself and some other guys I know that are really, really great at this, giving some classes, hopefully, to people that maybe have just gotten their Bones Kickstarter in from Reaper and have 250 or 300 odd or so miniatures that they would like to get started painting. So we're going to be stocking up on paint sets and brushes and quick shades and varnishes, and we'll be teaching people how to do glazes and washes and shading and dry brushing and all the other cool stuff.
Is that going to be a free event?
Yes, it's free. Awesome. Reaper does a really good job of providing stores with good promotional stuff like that. They do for stores and for conventions, they do something called a paint and take, where they provide a small number of figures, little paint pots and brushes to stores or conventions that want to just teach people how to paint. And then we're going to be ordering some of those along with some beginner paint sets. And of course, I'll have all of my paints and stuff available for that. That's going to be Saturday afternoon, the 27th of April. And the next event after that, sometime in May, we're going to try to do a flea market and auction. And we're going to put the call out for people to kind of go through their game collections and find stuff that they figure they could probably live without and would like to find a new home for, bring that stuff down to the store, and we're going to put all that stuff out on display. I will try to do a quick valuation on the more collectible of those items, and we'll put those up for auction to the highest bidder. The other stuff we will sell at prices that the product's owners decide upon, and the revenue generated from the sale and auction of those games will be transferred to the owners of those products in the form of credit in the shop. So if you bring down a couple of old games that you don't want anymore and you sell them for $30, You can use that $30 to buy somebody else's stuff at whatever price they're selling them for, or you can buy something off of my shelf.
I love
that. Just the same as if you had $30 in your hand. So that's that's going to be a little bit harder to pull off than the painting thing, because we need a lot more participation from our local gaming populace to help supply us with an inventory. But that's going to be sometime in May, probably toward the end of May.
Very cool. When you have a set date, we'll make sure we start putting the call out to the listeners that are local so we can try to drum up some extra audience for you.
Great. We'll definitely have a date in hand by the time the painting class takes place.
Perfect. And we'll be there as well. So nice.
Yeah, the people who are going to have Reaper Bones shipments in hand might include everybody on this show.
Myself also, I have to admit, I kicked in and I bought a bunch of extra stuff for the shop as well.
Cool. Looking most forward to it then. This has been a really interesting interview, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be here with us tonight.
Well, thanks guys, I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Well, with that said, I want to thank you again for coming on tonight, and on behalf of the vast Nerdstravaganza audience, say that we wish you well in your future endeavors with the Adventure Game Store and at Gamma.
Thank you very much, guys. Can I plug our Facebook real quick?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, you get the chance. It is facebook.com/Adventure Game Store.
And if you show up on a Friday night, you're more than likely to see the Ganzoids hanging out there playing some games. So stop on by.
Well, guys, I think it goes without saying that that was a very successful interview. Brian was an excellent guest, and this has been one of the better episodes of the Nerdstravaganza podcast. Speaking of which, all of our episodes are great, and I encourage all of our listeners who are users of iTunes to subscribe to our podcast, rate it favorably, and to write us heartfelt positive reviews about the excellence that we provide. Excellence in podcast broadcasting.
And if you don't like the iTunes, you can head on over to www.nerdstravaganza.com, where you can download the show, stream the show, rate the show, leave us a comment, or send us an email at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com.
And last, but certainly not least, join us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/nerdstravaganza. Like our page, join our insider group, and help us feel a little bit better about having such esteemed media cred. So I'm a little overwhelmed by that.
You and me both, brother. There's only one thing to say in response to all the media cred that we built up.
Peace!
Welcome, you dice rolling, role playing nerds, to episode 47 of the Nerdstravaganza podcast, where tonight we have a famous gaming guest for your pleasure. That sounded pervy.
He's a legend!